I'm Edgar B. Herwick III, and this is Boston Public Radio. So I think some people can relate to this story. I grew up in the woods in Pennsylvania, and you'd go walking outside around the woods, and sometimes you'd come home and you'd notice a sort of a burr maybe on your coat or on your sweater. And once you realized there was one there and you started to look a little closer, it seemed like they were popping up everywhere. There were dozens all over you. Well, I have noticed in the last few days, the same thing is true of crutch words. Now, these are words that are sort of filler. I just used one right there. I certainly use them. And once you start recognizing that crutch words are things that happen in everyday speech, you will see them everywhere. So we're going to talk a little bit about them, what they are, why we use them, and what do they say or what do they reveal about who we are. We're going to tackle those questions today ahead of the presidential debates, because as it turns out, these crutch words are not just being used by you and me in the regular populace, but we see it in our political leaders as well. With me to tackle all of this right now is Jen Dahl, who's a senior writer for the Atlantic Wire, and Peter Sokolowski, the editor-at-large for Merriam-Webster's. Welcome to you both. Glad to have you here on Boston Public Radio.
Great to be here.
Great to be here as well.
So, Jen.
Hi, Jen.
Hi.
All right. We're all ready to go. Here we go. Crutch words time. So, Jen, I want to start with you because this is something that you've written a lot about in The Atlantic. I want you to start right at the beginning for us and define, if you can, what you mean when you say crutch words.
When I say crutch words, I'm referring to expressions that we pepper throughout our language as verbal pauses. And we've seen this over and over again. I was a debater in high school, and we talked about these words. And I don't know if we called them crutch words, but we definitely called them verbal pauses. So in speech, we use this a lot. And I just did one right there.
Yeah.
It gives us time to think. Yeah. So it's also a way to accentuate meaning, as we saw with Biden recently at the DNC. He's using literally over and over again. He used it, I think, 9 or 10 times. And that is, Peter can talk about this more, but a hyperbolic use that is accentuating his meaning. When I say crutch words, though, I think we see them verbally, and we're also starting to see them on the internet, blogging, in all kinds of magazine writing now, because it seems that verbal communication and written communication are starting to merge more and more as we get kind of more folksy and talky in all of our conversations.
It's interesting. So one of the things I think that jumps out at me immediately when I hear you giving that explanation is it seems that there are two categories. And to me, they seem a little bit different. The idea of saying like or when you're talking to give you that moment to think, to give your brain that moment to catch up and formulate what the next thing you're going to say is, to me seems distinct from maybe what you're talking about with what Biden does, where he's using a word either for emphasis or to sort of draw an underline or a highlight on a word that he's going to say following. Peter, do you see the distinction there as a man who knows words better than almost anybody?
No, well, I'll go easy on that. But nevertheless, your distinction is exactly the one that we make, which is to say a group of sounds can convey meaning or not. And so in the case of a word that is used repeatedly that you might call a crutch word, or in some way used rhetorically, like Joe Biden's use of literally, clearly he was intending some meaning to be carried with that group of sounds, the word literally. But when you hear me say the word as I just did, I'm not necessarily conveying meaning. So that is what linguists might call filler.
Okay.
So we do have this distinction. Filler would be sounds that are essentially non-lexical, not carrying meaning. And the crutch words that Jen was talking about and her piece on crutch words in The Atlantic is so interesting to speak to this. The words that one repeats often.
Okay, so let's hear a little bit of Joe Biden. We've got a cut of Joe Biden, and it seems to me like Joe Biden goes to the word literally, not just in his DNC speech, but this is something that Joe Biden goes to often, maybe one of his crutch words. Let's hear some Joe Biden right now.
But literally, literally to change the direction of the world. I mean, literally, literally. I literally picked up the phone and called Johnny.
It's been a genuine, literal education being able to work with him.
He made his mark literally from day one.
All before we literally turned on the lights in the West Wing.
There's Joe Biden now.
I love that.
So, Jen, one of the things that I think that you've written about that I find interesting is this idea of one of the reasons why people maybe get frustrated or have a problem with this crutch word idea is that words often get used wrong when they're used as a crutch word. Is literally being used wrong here by Joe Biden, or is it typically used wrong when we use it? I'm going to throw that to both of you. Jen, why don't you start?
Well, there's extensive debate about literally even before this DNC speech was made. Literally is a word that people get really annoyed about. Literally and actually, I think, are kind of head-to-head in that competition. And people feel like you're using literally wrong because you're using it to convey something verbally. It's not literal at all. It's not on a page. It's not written down. And Peter can also speak to that more sort of formally, I believe. But I think from what I learned from him when I referred to him in writing that post was that literally is not wrong. It's a hyperbolic use that's existed from really early on. I think even the 1600s, Pope used it, and the very various other writers, Dickens used it. And so it's not incorrect, but we like to say it's incorrect also because when we hear things repeatedly and they seem to be cliches, that to us feels incorrect. Mm. And when we're talking about people who give speeches, we're more critical of them. It's also just fun to say you're sure. saying that too much and you're saying it wrong.
So, Peter, literally, is when we use literally in that hyperbolic way, that's correct? We're okay?
Sure. I mean, we have evidence of it, as Jen said, that goes back to the 17th century. I mean, basically, this is a term that is used in its original sense to mean in a literal sense or manner. That's, you know, the classic adverbial definition. So I took your words literally, or he was literally insane, that kind of thing. But then there's a second a development of figurative use, if you will, of the word that means in effect or virtually, which you might almost think is the opposite of its initial or oldest sense. And it's true, we give a usage note in the definition because this is a common question. Since some people take that figurative sense to be the opposite of the literal sense of the word literally, it's frequently called an error or criticized as a misuse. But instead, the use is pure hyperbole intended to gain emphasis, but it often appears in contexts where no emphasis is necessary. And clearly in political rhetoric, that's what you get. As Jen mentioned, Dickens used it in a sentence. He literally feasted his eyes in silence upon the culprit. And so that's a great sentence that's used. But it does go back to Dryden in the 17th century. Daily bread is literally implored and Pope used it. So the fact is, it has a literary history, of hyperbole. The point with Biden, though, and the point with, I think there's two points to make about this word. One is if you repeat a word, often enough, and it's a distinctive word, and it's a word that people notice. Mm-hmm. Then you're going to annoy people. It's going to be a verbal.
Maybe you're just
tip.
Solidifying your brand.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and as you know, that's certainly one way of doing that. But the thing is, that is a verbal tick, and that is something extra lexical, I might say. I mean, in other words, it's something that maybe isn't intended to carry meaning, but is simply a crutch, as Jen calls it.
So I want to get at what function these crutch words serve, because like I was saying in the beginning, once you start to recognize them, if you really start looking at them, I do them all the time. I have a few of them that I repeat over and over again. You hear people doing them all the time. The ones where we're talking about ums and uhs, it seems like that's pretty easy to get your head around why you would use that. You're trying to think of what you're going to say next. That makes sense. But some of these that are used as modifiers or used as descriptors that you're leaning on, why? Why do they get used?
Well, I mean, I'll jump in real quickly just to say, I mean, the linguists often call these discourse markers because they're used for emphasis or hedging, on the other hand. You know, so you're sort of perhaps indicating that's one of the classic uses of adverbial like, for example, so that you have he was like gorgeous, for example, you could say, in other words, you're saying that he's in the context, in the world. world of looks, he is approaching the gorgeous. Or you know, it's hard to translate. It's hard to translate exactly, but it is indicating some kind of meaning. So I wouldn't say that's a filler. And I do appreciate you know, the linguists who've chimed in on this online on Twitter, for example, the linguist at Missouri, Matt Gordon, and Jesse Scheidlauer from the Oxford English Dictionary, who hastened to point out that linguists for a long time have made the distinction. And again, Edgar, you're making the distinctions too, which is great, between sounds that carry no meaning and actual words.
Jen, I want to get your take on this, but actually what I want to do first is I want to open up our phone lines here. My sense is that this is something that people do, and I'm curious if folks out there have crutch words that they notice that they're using, or if there's particular crutch words that annoy them or that they notice being used that it sort of sticks in their craw a little bit. So here's our phone number. It's 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. Give us a call. Tell us about your crutch words. Are you an English teacher? How do you use your crutch words? Have you weaned yourself off using crutch words? Let us know right now, 877-301-8970. I'm talking with Jen Dahl, who's a senior writer at The Atlantic Wire, and Peter Sokolowski, who's the editor-at-large for Merriam-Webster's. Jen, you've written a lot about these crutch words. What are a few of the more common crutch words that you see being used or that you see people reacting to?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think going back to, you know, just a conversation just now, the personality of crutch words is fascinating, and this is not a scientific study, per se. This is something that I have picked up in listening to people and listening to debates and things like that, but also just being a word nerd type person myself, obviously. And in looking at the different words people say, Obama has used crutch words. He uses really frequently. And back in 2008, Letterman compiled a clip of him using it 30 times.
Yeah.
And that was dubbed an intellectual stammer, which is interesting, I think, in the context of talking about which words people are using now and the personality of those words. And then is a rather blank word, meaning nothing, but just giving you time to get ahead and plan what you're actually going to say. I think that we have, in speeches probably, and maybe in common use, moved away from and simply because they're so blank and meaningless and maybe considered a little bit not smart, that we're using these other words. So we're moving to words like honestly or as it were, which seems really highfalutin, or literally, which also seems pretty academic and intelligent, or people say, there was an article in the New York Times yesterday about the use of the word really, but as a snarky kind of question, like, oh, really? And that can be one, I think, or just saying really honestly to try to say that you're being honest, which might sometimes indicate that you're not being honest.
Right.
So it's really interesting.
Yeah.
The words that we choose, apparently, seriously, for the record, at the end of the day, in a weird way, basically.
Yep.
You know, there's so many of them. And when I wrote the first post, people started weighing in, and I got literally hundreds of emails telling me, you missed this one, you missed this one. What about whatever? What about with all due respect? What about works for me? The truth of the matter is, the thing is. So they just go on and on and on.
Yeah, speaking of them going on and on and on, we got a whole bunch of callers. Our phones are lighting up here. So let's get a couple callers in and hear what their take is on these filler words, on these crutch words. I'm going to start with line one. We got Lee in Jamaica Plain. Lee, what do you got for us?
Hi, I'm hearing people lately say a lot of times they start sentences with the word so, and I want to know where that came from. How did that become trendy? Also, people are saying a lot lately, they're saying, wait, what? Wait, what?
All right. So let's start at the beginning. So, to start a sentence, is that something that's on the rise? Do you see, Peter, is that something that's typical?
Oh, I mean, it's another discourse marker, and one that doesn't surprise me. I don't think it would surprise any linguist. I can't speak to its relative popularity, you know, whether it's becoming more common or less common. It basically is a sound that announces that I am about to say something, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of times the so-called filler or the crutch words are simply indicating to the person you're speaking to that I'm still speaking and I haven't finished the idea yet. In this case, one that introduces an idea.
Yeah, I think that's, you make an interesting point, because I think when I think about a lot of these crutch words, Peter, There is that sense of, you know, there's a lot of communication going on. When you get a so, or you get a, you know, here's the truth or something like that, sometimes these are used to say, what we've been talking about has been a whole bunch of chatter, but what I'm about to say, I want you to listen to right now. Mm. This sentence
Absolutely.
Right now is about to be the sentence that you need to listen to. So you say, so here's the deal. Boom. And mm-hmm. then you say it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I think I did like 15 filler words right there, in that 15 crutch words right there in that sentence. All right, let's get another.
But
call.
It is sometimes. I mean, that conjunction "so" it is sometimes criticized, as your caller did criticize it. The use of "so" to introduce a clause of result or purpose, it is considered standard. So the fact is, we do have it in the dictionary with that meaning.
Okay, excellent.
And we see that on the internet constantly.
Absolutely.
So, especially, you know, in a 140 character tweet, people may start it with a so, and it's a punctuation, I think, a kind of emphasis.
Yep. All right, so there you go. There's your answer on so. Let's move over to Bill in Gloucester, who's with us. And Bill, what is your crutch word story?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. In what way?
Overused word adverb in recent years is absolutely.
How do you hear it being used?
Just as an interjection, as a reply. It's used everywhere, always, all the time. It's just so overused, it makes me grit my teeth whenever I hear something. Absolutely.
Do you hate definitely also?
Pardon?
Do you hate definitely?
Oh, that's a subcategory of absolutely. But absolutely, in recent years, is absolutely the most... It's perhaps the only adverb left. adverbs have been dying out, but absolutely, it's going strong.
All right, well, there we go. Absolutely. Do either of you have a take on absolutely and its use or overuse right now?
Well, I think there is something to be said about words like literally, absolutely, and definitely, because there's something sort of, there's something going on with those words because their own definitions belie their use in these cases.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's
Absolutely.
Why people,
Absolutely.
That's why people notice them. I mean, people aren't calling to complain about the use of, she said the introductory so, but what about the, you know, word like and well? There are many words that are used, to introduce clauses. But when you have words, it almost becomes a peeve of people because the definition goes against its apparent use in this case, and almost resembles the so-called sentence adverbs, because we will stay in the category of adverbs here. And the sentence adverbs is easily described in this way. If you imagine yourself being on an airplane that's about to land, and the flight attendant announces that the plane will be landing momentarily, there are two categories of people. There are the people who broadly understand that means in a moment,
mm-hmm.
And there are which means that the word momentarily was used to modify the entire sentence. Or there are the peevers, the people who insist that it must mean for a moment.
Right.
In other words, that the adverb must be only modifying the verb, in which case it is seemingly unlikely or illogical that an airplane would be landing for just a moment and then popping back up in the air. So the fact is that you see that is the tension is between the literal, shall we say, definition of the term and its apparent meaning in context.
And I think it goes a bit further, too, in that words like absolutely or, for example, always almost present a challenge to an active listener who says to themselves, there's no way this can be always. There's no way this can be absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
What's missing here? Let me figure out and dig deeper. And that's what Peter is saying, kind of belies the original meaning as well. Seems like you might be hiding something if you say honestly all the time.
That's Jen Dahl. She's a senior writer for the Atlantic Wire. We've also got Peter Sokolowski with us. He's the editor-at-large for Merriam-Webster's Dictionary. We're talking about crutch words in advance of tonight's presidential debate, the first one, where we're all going to be now on the lookout for crutch words coming from either of the candidates. One thing I want to get into is this idea that the word crutch sort of has a negative connotation. But I'm curious about people using crutch words sort of strategically. And one example that I noticed is Michelle Obama at her DNC speech, which was widely applauded as a very, very good speech. And I happened to notice when she was giving this speech that she had this tendency when she was going to get into something very serious or very emotional that she would say, "You see," and then move on. Mm-hmm. I got a little bit of sound from that speech, and I want to get your take on this, both of you. Let's hear Michelle Obama at the DNC.
"You see, I've gotten to see up close and personal what being president really looks like. You see, even back then, when Barack was a... You see, Barack and I were both raised by families who didn't have much in the way... You see, for my dad, that's what it meant to be a man. You see, at the end of the day, my most important title is still mom and chief."
Jen, what's like your take with that there?
I like that we get two of those, at the end of the day. Together.
The elusive back-to-back crutch word.
Yeah. I think something that's really interesting about crutch words, and I don't know, you know, I sort of call them crutch words just for fun. I don't know if that's an official...
The literal term.
Sort. Yeah. But I like calling them that because I think that you do, in some ways, hobble along on them and use them to support you. But with Michelle Obama, and even with Biden saying literally over and over again, those are words that demonstrate a kind of conversational folksiness that I think is really appealing to people. We don't want our politicians to sound like robots. And we keep hearing Mitt Romney needs to be humanized and, you know, politicians need to be humanized. And I think in saying words like that, as opposed to just uttering out this perfect, smooth speech, we relate to, the listener gets to relate a little better. And it's another way of just slowing down a speech and making it less speedy and robotic.
Peter, I agree completely.
Did you find that that's something that's changing over time? I mean, when you listen back to speeches or read speeches from years and years ago, or even news broadcasts, I mean, the idea that things are becoming more conversational seems to be a trend. Is that something that tracks with what you see with your work, Peter?
Absolutely. And you know, Jen said this not long ago today. She said this disjunct between the written and the verbal, or the fact is that they are coming together. They're becoming more similar. There's a couple points I can make here. First of all, there are very few speakers who speak in complete paragraphs, you know, in that very classical and almost pre-written kind of way. I remember hearing interviews with our Justice, Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. This man speaks in complete paragraphs of these sort of interruptions or verbal pauses. But think of, remember the broadcaster Paul Harvey, who would use pauses in the same way that many of us use crutch words. And the real reason was to draw attention to what was to follow. Of course, Michelle Obama just now was really being persuasive. She was using a persuasive kind of rhetorical device. And, you know, the fact is you could call these verbal pauses just to get to the, you know, since Jen addresses the cultural aspect, to get to the sort of linguistics or scientific aspect, almost no one noticed these things before radio, which is sort of coincidental. We're talking about it today on the radio.
That's right.
But because those speeches, as you asked about, Edgar, the speeches, political speeches in the 19th century, for example, were more often yelled than spoken.
Yeah.
So they weren't a really good measure of speech fluency or disfluency, which is what a lot of this is called in linguistics terms, speech disfluency, which is the stuff you notice, the weeds in the garden. Once you notice them like a burr on your pants, you'll notice them every time. And there was a linguist last century, George Mall at Yale, who looked into speech disturbances, and he was studying anxiety and fear. He wanted to know, can we register like a lie detector test from someone's rhetoric, from the way that they speak? And he therefore created a sort of taxonomy. And it, you know, parenthetically, it's interesting that he did this in the context of the Cold War. What was he really trying to do? He was trying to see if people were lying about being a communist.
Right.
and the fact is, we laugh about it, but that was why he got, among other things, government funding to look into this. And so he made a taxonomy of 8 or 10 different ways in which you make verbal pauses. And the upshot is he didn't really find a good, reliable way of noting whether you're a communist or not. But he did broadly categorize people into two different categories. You're either a repeater or a deleter. And I'm a repeater, I think. You say ah and you repeat words. You might stutter a bit on a first syllable,
as I
just did. Or you're a deleter, which means you might change your mind mid-sentence and go back and start over. And that kind of person may be a more confident speaker in some ways, but these two categories, what he did find, people were internally very consistent.
That's very interesting stuff. I'm talking with Peter Sokolowski, who's the editor-at-large for Merriam-Webster's, and Jen Dahl, senior writer for The Atlantic Wire, who, among other things, has written about crutch words, which is what we are talking about here today. Jen, have you been, you know, I know that you follow politics, you follow the speeches that politicians are giving. Romney and Obama are debating for the first time tonight. Have you noticed, are there crutch words that either of these candidates have that we should be on the lookout for tonight when we're watching the debate?
Well, first, I think I love that this is even a conversation, and it gives us something fun to watch and listen for, because it makes it much more engaging than simply, you know, participating passively. If we can criticize our politicians for their word usage, I think that's fabulous.
That's right. Or make drinking games of it, which I've heard
exactly.
People do. I'm not saying that one should do that. I'm just saying I've heard that that's happened.
I think it's interesting, though. I'm really not sure what's going to come out of it. I think one thing that with Romney, his speeches tend to be pretty smooth, and he uses a lot of corporate words, but those aren't necessarily crutch words. We have seen, though, he smacks his lips a lot, and there have been clips of him doing that over and over and over again. So that might be something. It's not a crutch word per se, but
it's a crutch sound.
It's a crutch sound, maybe, or it's a way for him to pause and think ahead. I also read that Romney speaks much faster than the usual person. So he's getting out way more words, which may mean that he doesn't need crutch words. He's just kind of on autopilot. And
right.
Then Obama, I think we should watch for how many us he uses, because I feel like from 2008, he's probably worked on that, and we're not going to see it quite as much. But it'll be really interesting. A lot of the common words that they used at the DNC and at the RNC were similar. They both talk about America and jobs and moms and things like that. So those are subject words and
sure.
political words. But the crutch words are going to be really interesting. I'm excited to see what comes out of it.
Peter, for you, are there crutch words you've noticed that either of the candidates rely on?
You know, I haven't really thought about it when paying attention to the news. I will be paying attention to the speech tonight for a different reason. I'm going to be looking at what words people in the public look up in the dictionary following the debate hour by hour, because we found that with our dictionary, which is free online, and we get 100 million page views a month, so it's an enormous number of lookups, we tend to be able to measure people's immediate curiosity about a particular term. If it's in the news, or if it's uttered by a newsmaker. And so I will be watching to see what words that perhaps are asked maybe by the moderator, or words used in answers that trigger people, send them to the dictionary. So that's what I'll be watching. I'll be reporting that on Twitter. And I've been watching election terms for the whole season, and I find it fascinating to see which words people fix upon and actually get them to the dictionary.
All right. Well, there you have it. We are a nation of talkers, and we'll be paying attention to very closely to the words, both the words that the candidates are using and the words that they're leaning on as crutch words tonight at the debate. I just want to say thanks to our guests who are with us today. Jen Dahl, senior writer for The Atlantic Wire, and Peter Sokolowski, editor-at-large for Merriam-Webster's. Thank you both for sharing your expertise with us today on Boston Public Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And, of course, thanks to everybody who called. And also, if we didn't get to your call and you wanted to weigh in about crutch words, you can do so on Facebook, where the conversation never ends. All right, and Callie Crossley has made her way back here into the studio. What do you got for us, Callie?
Edgar, the debates are tonight, and to set up our next conversation, I'm going to play you a clip. What you're about to hear is a politician getting prepped for an upcoming debate.
Bring it.
Wait a second.
What?
Do you think anybody remembers the issues when there's a debate? When was the last time any human being, any American watched the debate and went, oh, God, Did you hear what he said?
I believe he talked about fiscal policy.
Oh, my God. My eyes are open and I can hear again.
Yeah, you're right. All they remember is Nixon sweating like Elizabeth Taylor after a Mexican meal. That's like...
I'm begging you, please. I'm like a man without water. Please, an acerbic comment, would it kill you?
I kind of wish Robin Williams was a part of the debate tonight.
Not so. That was from the movie Man of the Year, and we'll be talking about that movie and other films that have some classic debate moments. You're Edgar Herwick III. I'm Callie Crossley, and we're listening to Boston Public Radio.
You sure are.